This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
New science reveals Earth's protective ozone shield is still thinning, despite a long-standing international agreement to protect it. And no matter what you've heard about the big ozone holes over the poles healing themselves. Our risk of cancer and eye damage continues. From Zurich, Switzerland, we will talk with the lead author of that breaking science. But there's more, and you won't hear this from the mainstream media. Another just-published paper suggests that thinning ozone may have driven the planet's biggest mass extinction of land plants and animals. We have to rethink how extinction happens. We don't understand it, and we have to reevaluate the mega risk of thinning ozone. The lead author from University of California, Berkeley, will take us on that odyssey in our second half of the show. This is Radio EcoShock. We all know the 1989 ban on ozone-depleting chemicals was a success. The protective ozone shield is recovering, except it isn't. And that is according to a stunning new paper published February 6th in the European journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. We've reached the lead author, Dr. William Ball, in Switzerland. He is a visiting lecturer and researcher at the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science at ETH Zurich. He also works with the Davos World Radiation Center. Dr. Ball, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Your new paper, you know, it's one of the things I love about science. It doubts and it prods. What led you and your international team to question whether world ozone is recovering, despite reports that the polar ozone holes are mending?
This is really interesting, Alex. I think this is one of these tales of finding something new when you weren't even looking for it. I mean, the area of research I was doing a few years ago and still continue to do today is to try and understand how variability in the sun can influence on the atmosphere and the climate. And one of the ways it can do that is through modulating ozone in the upper stratosphere. So originally, in order to estimate how the sun can affect ozone in the upper stratosphere, in the upper atmosphere, what you need to have is lots of a long time series, lots of data sets covering a long period of time that have been merged together into a composite. And it's from those, when you apply statistical analyses, that you can extract the solar signal. This was the starting point. And the problem is that we have no satellite lives for very long. I think the longest living ozone observing satellite is about 20 years long, and variously they live from 5 to 10 years when in orbit. And when you put the data together, various teams around the world put the data together, and you can, when you pull out the solar signal, you get different solar signals based on different data sets, different composites. And so what we wanted to do is understand why we're getting a different solar signal, because there's only one sun, there's only one real variability in the atmosphere from the sun. And we developed methods to account for the differences between them. And when we did this, we saw a very clear recovery in the upper stratosphere, in addition to being able to extract the solar cycle. But what was really concerned us was that we saw this decrease in the lower stratosphere. And because we had applied these methods, these new algorithms to do this, we were confident that what we were seeing in the lower stratosphere was probably robust and real. And this then became of concern to us. So then we started our deep analysis that has turned into this paper in the last few days.
Brilliant. But before we go too much further, we do have to explain to some of the people what makes ozone in the first place, and then what makes it so important for life here on Earth. Now, that's a big topic. But let's just get a snapshot view of that, if we could.
So the presence of ozone in the atmosphere is really a consequence of the sun, actually. So we have oxygen in our atmosphere, the same oxygen that we breathe. And when it's high up in the atmosphere, the very, very strong ultraviolet radiation, high-energy radiation from the sun, the very radiation that actually the ozone layer protects us from, is able to break apart the oxygen molecule, which is made of two oxygen atoms, into two free oxygen atoms. And then what happens is that single oxygen atom then combines with an oxygen molecule. So you get the 2 plus the 1, and you get this molecule containing three oxygens, and that's ozone. And the very presence of this ozone that's now been formed from this high-energy radiation leads to a formation of a shield that protects us from more damaging radiation from different other wavelengths that are harmful to us. And this is very interesting because until oxygen sort of appeared in our atmosphere maybe 600 million years ago or further back in time, the ozone layer didn't really form until this oxygen came into the atmosphere and allowed life now to exist on land about 600 million years ago. So it's the presence of this ozone layer that allows life to persist outside of the oceans and is protected from ultraviolet radiation that actually is quite damaging to DNA, can cause all sorts of diseases, particularly skin cancer is a major one, or cataracts. So its presence here is essential to our survival and for the survival of the biosphere.
It's my understanding from your paper that ozone is mainly produced in the tropics. Then the question becomes, how and why does it migrate toward the poles?
The largest production of ozone in the atmosphere does occur over the tropics. It's sort of also at the subtropics, so out to about 30 north and south. And it gets to varying lesser degrees the further away you get from there. But the reason why we have a protective shield from the ozone layer all around the planet is because there is a large-scale circulation pattern. It's called the Brewer-Dobson circulation, which basically is a slow kind of equatorial to polar convection of air, which spreads out the ozone produced in the tropics to the mid-latitudes and the high latitudes. And this basically forms through several branches. So the stratosphere itself begins roughly about 10 to 15 kilometers above the Earth's surface, depending on where you live. If you're living at mid-latitudes, like in North America or in Europe, that'll be about 10 kilometers above you. So when you go on a transatlantic flight, you're roughly at the location at where the stratosphere starts, and it's above you, and that's where the ozone layer starts. And these branches are important because there are several of them. There's one in the shallow branch that takes ozone from the lower tropics into the lower mid-latitudes. And there's one that comes from the lower tropics and heads up to the highest altitudes in the tropical region, about 50 kilometers. And then it transports ozone slowly into the mid-latitudes or even higher and then down into the polar region to feed ozone into the polar region and into the mid-latitudes.
So there's a whole circulation system going on up there, but I was wondering, why is it important what happens to ozone in the lower stratosphere, closer to Earth, where you found it was thinning, if ozone in the upper stratosphere may be recovering?
So that's a very good question, and this is an issue that sort of complicates the previous picture following the Montreal Protocol that we were expecting the entire ozone layer to recover. I think what's really important here is that the upper stratosphere does appear to be recovering thanks to the implementation of the Montreal Protocol. But what we found in terms of decreases in the lower portion of the stratosphere seems to be of a slightly larger magnitude than the recovery we see above. So when you add up the contributions in the long-term changes, the changes in the lower stratosphere seem to largely win out over the upper stratosphere. I think it's an important point you raise. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not so much an issue of where the ozone is recovering or changing, but what that, in terms of our protection from damaging radiation at the surface, it's what's the total change in all the ozone between us and the top of the atmosphere. So this is what we call the total column ozone. And this includes ozone in the troposphere, that's the air near the surface where all the clouds are, where we live, and in the stratosphere, in the ozone layer itself. So it's the changes in all of these together that tell us about the total protection and how that's changing in the total column. So it's not so much where it is. But at the end of the day, our results seem to suggest that the changes in the lower part are winning out over the recovery in the upper part. And unfortunately, that suggests that there's been a very marginal continued decrease in stratospheric ozone in the last 20 years. Or at least today, it's slightly lower than it was 20 years ago.
We've all seen graphics showing the ozone hole over Antarctica shrinking with predictions it would be gone by the middle of this century. William Ball, what do you think?
I have to, in this case, defer to what I've learned from other scientists, from other experts. So even within the ozone layer community, there are experts in various different areas. And so I work more on looking at trends and variability in mid-latitudes and tropical regions. But from what I can see in my understanding of the atmosphere, from my studies, I think that there's very clear evidence that the predictions for recovery are very much in line with our modeling studies. And as far as I can see, I would have nothing to disagree with the expectations that by maybe 2065 or so, our climate models, our chemistry climate models, should suggest a recovery. And it takes quite a long time because the chlorofluorocarbons, these CFCs in the atmosphere, have a long residence time. So it will take a while before much of this has been sort of cleared out from the atmosphere and no longer has such a significant impact on the Antarctic ozone hole.
But could that ozone hole recover, and yet we still have thinning ozone overall, as your paper's been discussing?
That's right. So the results from our paper don't have a direct impact on the recent findings of a recovery in the ozone hole itself. So these are quite different regions of the planet that undergo different mechanisms that are dominating the changes. So you can't say, particularly from the work that we've found, that this has any sort of direct first-order impact on what's going on in the polar regions. For example, we also see the recovery in the upper stratosphere, and that's unaffected by whatever's driving the changes in the lower stratosphere, from what we can tell.
Now, another sort of layman's question. I know that here at Earth's surface, we create ozone, we humans, by providing these precursors, nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, also called VOCs, and then sunlight comes along and that becomes an unhealthy smog. What I'm wondering is, does that surface-level ozone that we create eventually rise up into the stratosphere, and if so, would that affect Earth's ozone balance?
So you're absolutely right about the production of these of ozone from the surface and from pollution from our own sources of industry and cars and cities, etc. But to answer your first question, no, not really. So the most of the ozone produced at the surface, it doesn't typically get up into the stratosphere, and if it does, it would be very, very small quantities that would have really very little effect on the ozone layer, the stratospheric ozone layer balance itself. So the tropospheric ozone is largely removed from the atmosphere through a process called dry deposition, so it tends to get removed by interacting with the surface and things. And also when tropospheric ozone gets into regions where there's very, very low levels of this substance called NOx, nitrogen oxide, it also typically can then get destroyed and removed from other processes. So it doesn't typically get up there. It is worth bringing up the point that in the total column, as I was mentioning before, that is the total amount of ozone between us and the sun, about 90% of it resides in the stratosphere and 10% resides in the troposphere. And there is some exchange more from the stratosphere to bring ozone into the troposphere rather than the other way around. That's more the way it works.
Is it more serious, Will, that ozone is not recovering between 60 degrees north and 60 degrees south, where most of the human population and most animals and plants live?
Oh, that's a very good question. So I would start out by first of all saying that at the moment, again, the thing that we need to be most concerned about at the surface is the total column ozone. So how many molecules of ozone lie between us and the sun? And from our analysis and from other studies, it's clear that this hasn't changed that much in the last 20 years. So in terms of our protection from ultraviolet radiation, we shouldn't panic. We shouldn't be overly worried at the moment because we still have this protective layer between us. But it is worth pointing out that, of course, the total column ozone isn't recovering at the moment or hasn't recovered significantly to levels before CFCs started to be used in large quantities and led to the decreases we saw prior to the implementation of the Montreal Protocol. But thanks to the Montreal Protocol, we are sort of in a situation where we're still relatively well protected, especially with the uses of sunscreen and protecting ourselves from the sun when we're out in it for too long. But it is, again, worth reiterating that any levels of decrease in the ozone layer has the potential to enhance DNA damage. In some sense, it is serious because the reason why the implications from our study for the reasons why the total column hasn't gone down in line with the small decreases we see in the stratospheric column is because essentially we've got tropospheric ozone coming to the rescue. And tropospheric ozone is not a good thing that we want to have rescuing us because it's a health and respiratory hazard, and it's damaging also to animals and plants. So this is a more speculative point to add, but as has been going on in Europe and America, should the world get to a point where it starts to clean up the pollution that causes tropospheric ozone, And we don't see changes that are positive in terms of the lower stratospheric ozone going back up, or it continues to go down, and this is highly speculative because we don't know what the trajectory of stratospheric ozone is, then that might then start to become something that we'd have more concern about.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. William Ball in Zurich, and researchers from Switzerland, the UK, America, Sweden, Finland, and Canada have used NASA satellites, the European Space Agency, and a Canadian satellite to show that Earth's ozone shield is not recovering as we all thought it would. And you've started to discuss why ozone is not recovering as expected. That's going to be everybody's big question. But before we go there, I just want to take a small detour into an earlier paper you co-authored that really caught my attention. And I'm referring to one called Atmospheric Impacts of the Strongest Known Solar Particle Storm of 775 AD. It was published March 28, 2017 in Nature Scientific Reports. What are solar energetic particles, and can they deplete stratospheric ozone?
Yeah, so this is a really nice study led by my colleague Timofey Sukhodolov, and this was looking into an historic event that was detected in the paleo record, from carbon record, from measurements and tree rings, of a very, very large solar particle storm. So a solar particle storm is essentially the product of a large eruption on the sun's surface that blows out lots of very high-energy particles, protons and electrons. And if it happens to be in the direction of the Earth, then these things will plow into the Earth's atmosphere, typically following along magnetic field lines that protect us and channeling them into high latitudes. You're right, it does have an effect on stratospheric ozone, but this is sort of usually these events typically are focused in high latitude polar regions, and they would tend to impact the upper stratosphere and the lower mesosphere. So this is the layer even higher up than the stratosphere, typically will produce these ions of what we call NOx and HOX, which can then lead to destruction of ozone in the upper stratosphere. But as far as we're aware, the effect is generally quite small on a sort of typical one of these events. They can be relatively large, but they tend to be short-lived, so they don't tend to be something that, from the surface point of view, we have to worry about, especially since it's at high latitudes, few people live. So there's not much effect in terms of the column ozone that we observe.
Are there other instances of serious ozone depletion in deep history, and so could our current problem be just a long-term cycle or a reaction to some non-human causes?
That's a good question. I mean, I personally don't really have a lot of knowledge about the long-term changes in the ozone layer, and of course there are little, if anything, in terms of observations. I mean, one would have to go to the modeling studies to look long, far back in history, you know, over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And so then you're in a situation where you'd be looking at using models which already have all the hypotheses in. Now, one of the hypotheses we put forward for the potential decrease in lower stratospheric ozone is a potential response to climate change, which is a warming of the troposphere, the lower atmosphere. And we know, of course, in the past that on very long time scales, there are slow changes in temperature that match where we've been today in the past. So the mechanisms that might drive a change in ozone, again, we might have seen similar things in the past. But we don't know what the mechanism is driving the lower stratospheric ozone. And from what we know from our models, we don't really reproduce this change that we're seeing now. So, but it's still possible it could be related to climate change. And so it may have happened in the past. But again, this is highly speculative. I don't have any evidence to support this line of thinking. It's just coming from what I know in terms of modeling studies.
And then others have suggested that very short-lived substances, or VSLSs, have a role in the ozone story. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the honest answer is that they might. So to explain, very short-lived substances are compounds, that the ones that at least we have evidence that are increasing are man-made. And these are similar to chlorofluorocarbons in that they're molecules, compounds containing chlorine and bromine, which are the key things that were in chlorofluorocarbons and ozone-depleting substances that were banned by the Montreal Protocol. And very short-lived substances, they're called very short-lived simply because they typically are only thought to survive about 6 to 12 months in the atmosphere, not long enough to get up into the stratosphere. And so they haven't been regulated by the Montreal Protocol because they haven't been considered to be a serious threat. There's been a few studies recently, a couple of modeling ones, where they've shown that there is the potential for the rises in or increases in emissions of VSLSs over the last few decades, if they continue, could potentially have a slowing effect on the recovery of the ozone layer, but not to the extent that they would prevent it. And just a few months ago, there was a study that showed that there were actually much higher levels of these emissions or concentrations in the above the surface over Southeast Asia, and indeed even levels higher than expected close to the interface region that will then bring the air containing VSLSs into the lower stratosphere. But there is no direct evidence of high concentrations of these VSLSs that could potentially have the impacts that we are seeing in terms of the decreases in lower stratospheric ozone. So again, this is a hypothesis that would need to be investigated.
The success of the 1989 Montreal Protocol has been held up as a model of international action to solve a life-threatening environmental problem, and some say it inspired the Paris Accord on climate change. Your new scientific announcement about the ozone, it's not happy news, either for environmental safety, obviously, but also for the political process. Your thoughts on that?
That's an interesting question. I think the first thing I would say is that we need to be careful about mixing what we've found here with the political process in terms of protecting the ozone layer through the Montreal Protocol. Because so the first thing to say is that the study doesn't have anything to say in terms of the effectiveness of the Montreal Protocol, because we know that the Montreal Protocol has been highly successful. You see a closing of the Antarctic ozone hole in the last few years. Studies are starting to confirm this in line with our expectations. It's very clear that in the upper stratosphere, there is a recovery underway and that ozone is recovering up there in line with our projections from chemistry climate model studies. And in some sense, even more important, it's clear that the total column has stopped declining. That's the total protection and in terms of the ozone between us and the sun. This is fantastic news. And that's the result of this political process that led to the Montreal Protocol and all of its amendments. So had the Montreal Protocol not been implemented, so projections suggest that by 2060, maybe two-thirds of the global protective ozone layer would have been lost. And that would have very serious implications for people living at the surface and life in general living at the surface, let alone the benefits to the radius of forcing in terms of climate change that are avoided. So I would say that this doesn't have an impact on that highly successful political process. Now, from an environmental safety perspective, and for us at the surface, the decreases that we're seeing in the ozone layer now are quite small. They seem to be persistent, they seem to be robust, but they're much smaller than what was happening before. And at the moment, the decreases are being roughly balanced by tropospheric ozone increases from what we infer from our study. And this is also not a good trade-off because tropospheric ozone, as I said earlier, is bad for our health. So if these trends continue into the future in stratospheric ozone, then it may become a more serious problem that we need to be concerned about. But I think for now, the key is that scientists get on and understand what is going on here and why this is happening.
What do we need to find out? What are the next steps to solve the mystery of why our ozone shield has continued to weaken, even if only slightly, despite our best efforts?
I think at the moment, the thing that really needs to happen is that the scientific community now has several avenues that it would need to sort of go down and investigate. So very roughly, I would say that, first of all, it is certainly worth going back to the data and to understand the uncertainties in the data itself, in how these merged products were made. I mean, even the work that we've done to try and account for problems in the data, there's much more that can be done on that. There's also uncertainties in how we attribute or identify the long-term changes in the statistical analysis itself. And this is something that a lot of researchers are also actively engaged in addressing at the moment. Now, in terms of the hypotheses, these are things that should be addressed because despite the issues with time series analysis, statistics, and the data, the real implications from our result are quite clear that this is highly likely to be a real trend that we've detected in the atmosphere. So addressing the hypotheses that it could be very short-lived substances, that would should be taken from direction of both modeling studies to, if, for example, we didn't put the right boundary conditions, as in the right emissions into our models. It's not that our models are not doing a good job in simulating changes. It's just that we didn't tell it what the right inputs were. It's like if we didn't put the right CO2 emissions into a climate model and then we didn't see the temperature response, that was because we didn't set the model up right. So that's something to look at. The other idea would be then, because we see these elevated, very short-lived substances in the atmosphere, it might be prudent to start to look at the emissions of these more thoroughly and build better inventories and to see what's up in the stratosphere. But the other aspect that needs to be investigated is the potential that this is really now connected. These changes we're seeing in the lower stratosphere are now connected to changes in the climate, because we know that the stratospheric circulation pattern should be modified by the increasing temperatures in near the surface due to dynamical changes. And it's possible that our models are struggling in that specific region, because we know that they do very well in other parts of the climate system. But they might be struggling in that particular region for a number of reasons, and that the modeling community will probably want to investigate this aspect of climate models as well to see if the decrease in ozone is related to this aspect. So there's multiple fronts upon which we can take. And I would also suggest that it would be very prudent that we continue to take observations, that we continue to maintain our observing network. Because at the moment, funding seems to be being restricted all around the world for the less exciting science in some sense of just continuing to monitor what's going on with the ozone layer, because the Montreal Protocol has been so effective already. And I think it's prudent that we continue to fund these observations to make sure that we keep an eye on what's going on with the ozone layer, despite the Montreal Protocol's success.
By all means, let's keep watching it, because so much of our life depends upon it. And we have been discussing the paper, Evidence for a Continuous Decline in Lower Stratospheric Ozone, Offsetting Ozone Layer Recovery. And it was published February 6, 2018, in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. Find links to the lead author, Dr. William Ball, the science and the issues in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Will, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists warn we are in the sixth great mass extinction event here on Earth, but it doesn't look like it to the average person. What if extinction is not a sudden event like we see in the movies, like an asteroid hit, but it's a long, slow decline? A new theory suggests that was the pattern about 251 million years ago, when up to three-quarters of all land species went extinct. They disappeared. Earth deforested on a global scale, and a depleted ozone layer may have been a surprise driving force. This shatters our assumptions about how extinction works. The new paper was just published February 2018 in Science Advances. The title is UVB-Induced Forest Sterility: Implications of Ozone Shield Failure in Earth's Largest Extinction. The lead author is a rising star in ancient botany, PhD candidate and researcher Jeff P. Benka. He's from the Loy Lab at the University of California in Berkeley. Jeff Benka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
When you came to Berkeley from the University of Washington, what did you bring with you?
So when I came from University of Washington, I gained a background in studying ecosystems from a fisheries ecology perspective and in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. And there I met a few people who actually were working with ultraviolet B radiation associated with ozone weakening. And I also then worked with a number of folks in paleobotany in the lab of Dr. Caroline Stromberg and the lab of mass extinction paleobiologist Dr. Peter Ward. And during those years, I really started getting an idea of, oh, well, there's a lot of interesting sorts of connections between what modern ecologists are looking at in biology today and maybe what we could learn about the distant past.
We've had Dr. Peter Ward on the show, I think it's three times. I love his work. In this new paper, you say an unanticipated result tipped you into a new adventure in science. What happened?
When we went into this research, we were interested in figuring out how pollen grains in the fossil record, why they might look malformed. And one of the ideas is that maybe there was ozone weakening going on in the past. And so we decided to design an experiment to test this idea or this hypothesis on modern lineages of plants that were produced very similar pollen to the lineages affected 250 million years ago during the end-Permian extinction. And while we went into the study expecting to possibly see these malformed pollen grains as sort of a fingerprint of environmental stress, we were really taken aback and surprised by the observation that the trees in our chamber experiment actually had all of their seed cones die prematurely. So their seed cones died before fertilization. And that really got us thinking about a different way in which this extinction may have played out for ecosystems.
So the trees didn't die, but their reproductive cones did.
Exactly. So in pine trees, there are two different types of cones that are produced. You may all be familiar with seeing the products of one of these cones, pollen cones. Each year, you might get a dusting of yellow pollen at certain times, and that's oftentimes from very large pollen grains of pines and their relatives. The second type of cone is a seed cone, and that's often what we term these big woody pine cones. And it was those seed cones, the pine cones, that we were seeing that were dying before they were able to receive sperm from pollen grains during fertilization.
We know that ultraviolet rays coming from the sun can be really harmful to human eyes and skin, and scientists break down those rays into three basic types that I'm aware of, A, B, and C. Why do you focus on UVB?
We were focusing on UVB because this is one of the most biologically relevant wavelengths. It's a short wavelength that often causes mutations in DNA. So we here on Earth get exposed to both ultraviolet A or UVA and UVB radiation. But a lot of times the UVB is what biologists are most concerned with in terms of mutation.
So we need to enter this time machine. Your paper looks at the worst mass extinction event on the planet. How do we even know the Permian-Triassic extinction happened?
The Permian-Triassic extinction was a major event in geological history, and it really came together as an observation of the disappearance of very large percentages of fossilized life forms. So predominantly we're talking about marine ecosystems. So a lot of times marine or oceanic sediments are where much of the fossil preservation takes place in the world. I mean, that's where we get at least some of the most complete records of what's going on over time. And in marine sediments, we see these just massive disappearances of animals, say, with hard shells that readily fossilize. It's almost sort of a sudden event. They're there, and then they're gone when you're looking up basically a rock section. And for a long time, paleontologists have been puzzled about why this difference in animal diversity between the end of the Permian period and the early Triassic period. And there have been many, many different sorts of ideas for how these oceanic extinctions happened. And actually, your former guest, Peter Ward, does a lot of research on this and has found some very interesting things. And in our case, we actually are trying to figure out what's going on land. It's a very different system than the ocean. There's different forces probably at play. And in land, we see as these marine species disappear, we actually see a very interesting change in land plants. My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, here at UC Berkeley, during her dissertation years ago, working with her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, they found that in marine sediments of Greenland, that pollen assemblages that were deposited right in the same sediments that we see this change in shelly faunas or animal assemblages, there is this sort of pulsed change in the vegetation going on. And they published this noting that there seemed to be this disappearance of woody seed plants. So there were these diverse conifer and what we call gymnosperm-dominated plant groups that really started to dwindle during several points. But the really weird thing is that they didn't just go extinct like the animals did. The plants actually persisted, and they actually lived long enough to basically recover and then get hit again by something. So there was this repeated deforestation, sort of pulsed change in the forest community that was going on, and we see the same sorts of plant lineages moving out of the system over and over again until eventually, much further down the line, some of these lineages, for instance, many of the conifer lineages, didn't make it, and only a few were able to survive the actual full crisis.
Now, what are the Siberian traps, and how do they fit into the accepted story of this mass extinction?
So the Siberian traps are what we call a large igneous province. It's a very massive area that was formed by volcanic activity that spans much of northern Russia today. And the Siberian traps were really pertinent for the end-Permian extinction because they basically formed at the same time as this extinction happened. And there's been a number of recent studies that have been looking to date the lava flows and the lava deposits of this volcanic province to figure out just how that timing lines up with the extinction. And recent years, it's been found that some of these eruptive sort of intervals probably lined up very closely, more or less, give a few, you know, tens of thousands of years, which is very short, geologically speaking. And the eruption ceased about, we think, maybe about 500,000 years into the early Triassic period. So it's somewhere from tens of thousands to a million years of volcanic activity that was going on across a very large area of what is now Russia. And this sort of volcanic province has been tied to, or at least has been proposed to be tied to, many of the phenomena we see in the animal records. Scientists propose that many, many different sort of environmental impacts that volcanoes can have on the environment may have really pushed life past its tipping point. For instance, these volcanoes likely produced loads of methane and carbon dioxide, well-known greenhouse gases today, that would have probably accelerated and pushed Earth into these sort of hothouse worlds, basically like these extreme global warming episodes that are sort of our doomsday calculations for the future. And that's one thing on the one hand that has really been proposed as driving a lot of these environmental changes, among many others. There's also heavy metals, acid rain, that have been proposed to have wreaked havoc on land. One of the problems, though, with some of these hypotheses is that we don't really know how we can explain the plant dynamics using them. So in many cases, the acid rain sort of idea is quite interesting and quite pertinent to what we've seen in recent years with industrial pollution. But the problem with that idea is that acid rain is a localized phenomenon, roughly speaking. So the Siberian traps were actually erupting up in what is now, or what would have been, the Arctic at that time. And so a lot of these sorts of extremely stressful conditions would have been going on in the northern hemisphere. They wouldn't have reached down to the southern hemisphere to the same extent. And that's where we also see forest collapses.
With the volcanic activity, a lot of it over thousands of years, how does that impact the ozone and therefore the UVB rays that you were studying?
My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, and her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, discovered that across the world during this mass extinction, there is this proliferation of what look like abnormal spores. Particularly, they're spores that are clustered in groups of fours called tetrads. And they were produced by a lineage of plants called lycophytes today. They're represented today by modern club mosses, quillworts, and spike mosses that you can find, say, if you go hiking in the mountains in North America or elsewhere. Now, the thing that was interesting about these spores and that really tipped them off that something might be going on is that it seems that these spores were unseparated during the process of meiosis, the process of basically spore production. And this would suggest that something was disrupting the reproductive process of plants worldwide. These spores were all over the world where you looked, and there were many of them. So they proposed an idea that Siberian traps might have been causing massive destruction to the ozone layer. And this idea came out of similar ideas with the Siberian Trap, generating gases that could cause atmospheric degradation or pollution, similar to industrial pollution today. That study was published in 2004, and about 5 years later, in 2009, a team of scientists led by Dr. Henrik Svensson found that volcanic sediments that formed around basically eruptive pipes of the Siberian Traps, when you take these rock sediments and you stick them in chambers and heat them, they release massive amounts of methyl chloride, an ozone-depleting compound. These volcanoes actually were erupting possibly in the absolute wrong place at the wrong time. Across Siberia, there were these massive evaporated seaways. We call them halite deposits or salt deposits today. And these salt deposits basically were getting either punctured or heated by these magma conduits. And as the Siberian Traps was forming, this whole gigantic region was having a lot of heating of these salts. And heating of those salts, even passively, can release and unlock methyl chloride and methyl bromide, ozone-depleting compounds that can reach the stratosphere and rip holes in the ozone layer in the Arctic.
But we don't have any mechanism to directly measure the ozone levels 250 million years ago, do we? Or do we just depend on the way that the impacts are seen?
At the moment, we don't have a direct way of measuring UV radiation in the past. However, there's exciting new research coming out of a team, I believe, that's in England right now, that's led by a researcher by the name of Wesley Fraser. And he and I believe Barry Lomax and a number of other colleagues there have developed a way to look at the chemistry of fossilized pollen and spore walls that actually can be used potentially to figure out the levels of UV radiation that these plants may have been experiencing. So the thought is that plants oftentimes invest sunscreen-like pigments. We call, for instance, one of them is called flavonoids, that they basically put into their spore or pollen walls. It probably helps give a lot of pollen its yellow color if you do see it in conifers. But the amount of that sunscreen that is basically produced by the plant oftentimes has a direct relationship to the amount of radiation the plant receives. So in the coming years, you may well be able to be seeing some studies coming out on the N-Permian from that group. I know they've been really working hard testing this with other systems and more recent sediments, and they've found their results so far are very promising, that this, what we call a proxy or an indicator, might actually have some application to the N-Permian.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with my guest Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. We're talking about damaged ozone and mass extinction. Do we know, Jeff, what the level of ozone is when tree cones begin to become damaged, begin to become less fertile?
So we don't know exactly what the level, the threshold of ultraviolet radiation exposure actually will induce infertility in trees or start seeing a noticeable impact on their inability to produce seeds. More work definitely needs to be done looking at lower UVB levels than what we looked at in our experiment. But what we found in our study was that the lowest UV treatment that we used that was simulating what was modeled through paleoatmospheric and geochemical models was 7.2 times the modern amount of UV radiation that, say, you would get on a really sunny day here in California. Which is enough. You should be putting on sunscreen if you're hanging out outside in the middle of the day in California. These were extremely high radiation levels we were testing for these trees, otherworldly, you would say. But we really don't know, because this actually is the first study where anyone has actually looked at the reproductive biology of a non-flowering plant under high UV radiation and whether it impacts that. So we're really just at the tip of the iceberg here. I think that a number of research studies could be done that could really explore how low the increase of UV could be to actually impact our forest health in the world today.
You also talk in the paper, and this goes to your previous discussion about pulses, but you talk about a forest recession episode. Are they prevalent in Earth's past, and why do those happen that way?
So the forest recessions that happen at the end Permian are pretty unique to that event in the pattern that they happen. There definitely are areas where we see an instance of deforestation after the asteroid impact when the dinosaurs went extinct at the Cretaceous Paleogene. And that's sort of a widely cited and mentioned effect of that extinction, is that we see a decline in the forest vegetation in our fossil pollen spore and what we call macrofossil assemblages, so large actual fossils of plants. The really unique thing about the end Permian is that we get this really unique turnover in the vegetation, and it happens over and over and over again. It's strange. And eventually, at the very end of these forest recessions and recovery intervals, we see the disappearance of a number of these lineages. And it almost seems like there just was something that was stressing these communities out, you know, over thousands and thousands of years, that the trees and the plants were resilient. They were survivors, but eventually some of them weren't able to take it after a while. So it really is a testament that something was going on that snuffed out a lot of the animals that the plants were able to tolerate for a very long time.
Do you think some ancient plants had better ways to cope with UVB light, and so maybe they survived with a better competitive advantage?
Yes, we do think that's quite plausible. I mean, these plants are being subjected potentially for tens to hundreds to thousands of years of whatever conditions were present in the Permian world. And with that, there was probably very intense selectivity going on in the ecosystem. So some lineages, some strains, some genetically, there might have been some populations that were more resilient and possibly selected for over time. I mean, when I say selected for, that sounds very deterministic, but they probably had traits that were advantageous for coping with ultraviolet. And one of the lineages of plants that was out there that really was a champion of this extinction is one that my advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, spent some time studying. And they were these lycophytes, the ones that were forming these weird spore tetrads. We really have no idea what they were doing exactly at this time, but they took over the world. In each one of these deforestation episodes, we see possibly just a handful of genera of these lycophytes just pop up, and they're there. And there's sort of these low-diversity ecosystems dominated by these spore-bearing fern-like plants that really aren't related closely to ferns at all, but do very different things.
If the forests began to die due to infertility from UVB, due to ozone depletion, how do you connect that to the much larger extinction of plants and animals of all kinds that happened around 250 million years ago?
One of the ideas we're having with this extinction is that by disrupting the reproductive capacity of dominant plant lineages around the world, and dominant is really kind of an anthropomorphic term. I mean, these are lineages of plants that seem to be very common and very prevalent in many assemblages we see in the fossil pollen and spore records. But the idea that we have here is that as these forests were unable to replace themselves over time, if you had, say, pulsed ozone weakening from these volcanic outbursts over and over again over thousands of years, we may have seen recession of the forests over generations. And with that, the disappearance of fundamental niches of animals around the world. In a way, we're proposing a different way of looking at extinction and the end Permian in general, in that it is a very dramatic event, and we don't want to downplay that by any means. But the mechanism by which this extinction and possibly other mass extinctions have happened may really have more to do with the role of natural selection over long periods of time under environmental stresses. And it doesn't necessarily require that anything really is starving to death or dying, but that the ecological space and the niche of organisms is changing over thousands of years, and it's changing the number of possibilities that animals, of where an animal can live and how it can function, and we're seeing the disappearance of ecosystems over time.
I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. This is Radio EcoShock. Now, Jeff, we get to a much stronger warning in your paper that we could be underestimating the threat of thinning ozone. Let's start with the picture you give of what would have happened if the Montreal Protocol banning some of these ozone-killing chemicals wasn't in place.
If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we could have really been in deep trouble, not only for our own skin cancer, say, for our species, but also for ecosystems in general based on this study. If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we actually, by 2050, might have seen the complete disappearance of the ozone layer in the tropics, which is really alarming and scary. And actually, within the past few days, there's been a new study suggesting that ozone weakening is continuing over at least the tropics, or at least it hasn't really fully healed itself in the way that it has over the Arctic. And we really should still be a little concerned about this and figure out what's causing it. But the other thing that's really alarming about this world-avoided scenario, a previous study done by Newman et al. In 2009 did atmospheric modeling of what the world would look like and its atmosphere would look like by the year, say, 2065. And by that time, we would probably see a 550% increase in DNA-damaging UV radiation in the mid-latitudes, so where a lot of people live here in North America and also in the Southern Hemisphere, too. And with that, we may have seen, much of the world's land surface is covered by coniferous forests. So the coniferous taiga is one of the largest biomes on land today. And what's particularly concerning about this experiment is that though it was done on only a single species of cultivated conifer, it really was a dramatic result that we got. Every single one of these trees was sterilized under all of our increased UV scenarios. And they use the exact same mode of reproduction that a wide range of the conifers dominating the taiga today do. So if we didn't curb these CFCs and ozone depletant pollutants, we might have seen recession over time and possibly disappearance of forests that we rely upon for shelter, timber, but also for our ecosystems in general. And that's a really scary thought.
And you warn we must not slack off on restrictions on chemicals that can damage the ozone layer. Is anybody suggesting that?
We do suggest that. And as far as I know, I haven't necessarily seen direct proposals to curtail ozone or basically the CFCs or any ozone-depleting pollutants. But I think that one of the big issues now is that politically we're in a time where there are economic incentives sometimes that are short-term to lessen or curtail restrictions on environmental pollutants. And we're seeing that here in the United States at the moment, which is a concern to a lot of researchers. But the ozone problem is really, really a long-term issue, too. It's got some parallels to climate change and CO2 and methane emissions. But one of the things that's still really of concern for this is that there are newer chemicals that we are producing that we don't always know all of the environmental effects down the road of when they get in the atmosphere. So some environmental pollutants that are still out there still are able to damage ozone, stratospheric ozone, to some extent. So we need to just make sure that we are really doing rigorous study on these environmental pollutants and continuing to do so, so that we avoid possibly reintroducing a new problem inadvertently.
Jeff, your new paper suggests a new way of looking at mass extinction and the risk of ozone depletion. It is new science. Would you call this a theory, a postulate, or what?
Well, it's funny. My co-author, Dr. Ivo Downstay, on this paper has really been very heavily influential in this new, what we call this new view of extinction. And he often says that it's not really new. It's not necessarily new. It's also should be an old view of how extinctions are. Really, what we're proposing is, we're a team in a biology department, and it's interesting because being amongst biologists day in and day out, we think about these events possibly a little differently than we would if we were mostly thinking about the geology of the situation. And to modern biologists who study modern ecosystems, it's incredibly hard to figure out what drivers of ecological change are in the modern world, even if you have all the advanced tools and technologies at your fingertips. So trying to look back 250 million years is really, it's almost unfathomable. But one of the things that we got out of sort of talking to modern biologists and thinking about this is that there are modern systems today that give us an idea of what maybe an extinction world would have looked like. And one of the really, really compelling examples of this is the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And you see all these very gripping film footage, photography that is done in this area where a number of biologists are working. Some of them, I think you've actually even interviewed in the past. But you see that Chernobyl looks like a beautiful, idyllic landscape right now. If you didn't know what had happened there and you were ignoring, say, the ruins of what was going on there, you'd probably put up a tent and go camping or backpacking there. And you'd see all sorts of wildlife and all sorts of trees, parklands. But there's really more insidious things going on that are unseen. And to a biologist or someone who studies ecosystems, you really have to put together a lot of pieces of information before you see a dramatic sort of impact going on in the ecosystem. And that may play out over tens to thousands of years, and we may not know it. So the view that we see with extinctions in the past is that maybe they weren't these massive die-offs. Maybe it was more insidious, smaller changes that affected the selectivity of certain lineages over time. And over time, you have the disappearance of lineages. Dr. Downstay really argues in many cases that we really should think of mass extinctions as the termination of lineages on the tree of life. It's not necessarily that everything drops dead. It's that evolutionary lineages disappear over geologic time at a faster rate than newer lineages or newer branches to the tree of life can sprout.
Yes, you conclude in the discussion part of your paper, environmental disasters in the past and present, for example, current anthropogenic climate change, are therefore not always easily perceived as they unfold. That's kind of a scary thought that we could be blindly walking into a slow-moving environmental disaster right now and not know it. We've been talking about paradigm-busting new science, in my opinion. The paper is UVB-induced forced sterility, implications of ozone shield failure in Earth's largest extinction. Our guest is Jeff Benka from the UC Museum of Paleontology and the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of California in Berkeley. Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all the time we have, at least for this week. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.